In 1941, President Roosevelt talked to a number of service organizations attempting to find a way to boost military's morale. He talked to the YMCA, the YWCA, the National Travelers Aid Association, National Catholic Community Association, and the National Jewish Welfare Board. And out of all these organizations, they came up with an organization that they called the United Service Organization, or USO for short. And for the last three quarters of a century, the USO has been serving men and women in the military and their families from the time they sign on the dotted line until they're discharged. There are USO centers around the world. I think there are like 200 of them. There are U.S. airport centers to assist the military servicemen and their families as they travel. The USO sponsors tours with celebrities to boost morale. So it's really a very worthwhile organization, and it's entirely funded by persons, individuals, organizations, corporations. The federal government has nothing to do with it. During the summer of 1958, I attended an NROTC prep school in Bainbridge, Maryland. They had a prep school there for the Naval Academy for those who were getting ready to attend. And they also had a prep school for people going back to college under the NROTC program. They would pay your room, board, and tuition for your school, and you would go on a cruise during the summer for training, and you'd do that all 3 years, and at the end of the 4 years, you'd get a commission as an ensign in the Navy. But then you had to serve for 4 years of active duty. So you got an education, but you paid for it. And anyway, a number of us would go to Baltimore, which is about an hour drive away from the training center there, on the weekends when we had liberty. And we'd go to the USO to relax and, you know, have a change of pace. They had ping pong tables, they had pool tables, the ladies, the hostesses served refreshments, there was a floor for dancing, and they had dances during that time. Anyway, during that summer, I met a girl who invited me out to her home to meet her family, and I went out there. The interesting thing was, I couldn't go in the house, I had to sit on the porch. And that seemed a little strange to me. And at that time, and I don't remember in thinking back about it exactly how she explained it, but she said I was a Gentile. And of course, that name made nothing to me, absolutely nothing, until later on when I became acquainted with the church and was baptized and found out about, the difference between Jews and Gentiles, the distinction. In thinking back about that, I thought, it's a good thing she didn't invite me in January, because the shore patrol would have been out collecting stiffs if someone was sitting out on a porch in that kind of weather. So I don't know what she did at that time. I mean, she, was trying to be nice, and as they are, and in any event, I met another girl. Her name was Janet Esserwine. And at the time, that name didn't mean anything to me either, until later on I was in the church when I found out that was a Jewish name. And in thinking about her, she was very, she had a dark tan, jet black hair, a very pretty girl. And she invited me to dinner at her home to meet her parents. And of course, that was contrasting how she treated me to the way I was treated by the other girl, was quite a contrast. Anyway, when you've grown up in a community where you don't hear anything. Have at least the one that I did. I never knew too much about Jews, only what I read about them after the war. But anyway, you know, it was just an interesting thing to contrast the way I was treated. Well, the world can look pretty bleak. It can look pretty dismal. It can look pretty dim sometimes if you're adrift in a strange city, like most servicemen are. So the USO was really a blessing to servicemen and continues to be. We received an email recently from the festival coordinators of the feast sites we were attending, going to attend, giving us speaking guidelines and highlights, and it just kind of brings into focus the fact that the feast is only 11 weeks away. Now, that's somewhat long, but yet those weeks go by very rapidly. You know, most of us have already registered, we've already made our housing reservations, but there's a number of you who still haven't done that. And if you need any help with your registration, please see me and I can help you with that. Turn to Zechariah 14, verse 2. Zechariah 14, verse 2. It's talking about a time just ahead where God says, "For I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the houses rifled, and the women ravaged, and half of the city shall go forth into captivity, and the residue of the people shall not be cut off from the city." And you don't have to turn there, but I'm just going to paraphrase John 18:36, where God says, "My kingdom," or Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight." So there's a time when his servants will fight. And at that time, that I should not be delivered to the Jews, but now is my kingdom not from hence. So at that time, it wasn't appropriate. It would be someday, but not then. Continuing in Zechariah verse 3, "Then shall the Eternal go forth and fight against those nations as when he fought in the day of battle." And jumping to verse 9, "And the Eternal shall be king over all the earth. In that day shall there be one Lord, and his name one." So we haven't reached that point at all, certainly. And if you think of a certain denomination that said that he came back in 1914, you wonder, if that was the case, what has been happening since that time? Because there's certainly no one that is the king of the entire earth. And yet that's what is prophesied to happen. Going to verse 16, "And it shall come to pass that everyone that is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem shall even go up from year to year to worship the King, the Eternal of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles." So here's a place where he says all the nations, all of the people that were trying to destroy Jerusalem, are now going to come up and they're going to worship the Eternal of hosts and keep the Feast of Tabernacles. So that's a guarantee of something that's going to happen in the future. Verse 17, "And it shall be that whoso will not come up of all the families of the earth." Here, once again, emphasis on all of the families of the earth. "All of the families of the earth unto Jerusalem to worship the King, the Eternal of hosts, even upon them shall be no rain." You know, there's no longer going to be a distinction between Jews and Gentiles. Everyone is going to be worshiping God, and they're going to be worshiping together during the Feast of Tabernacles. But if they don't, they're going to not receive rain for a while. Verse 18, and if the family of Egypt go not up and come not, that have no rain, there shall be the plague wherewith the Eternal will smite the heathen that come not up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. So if the withholding of rain doesn't do it, then God's going to use a little stronger method. They're going to be infested, or they're going to be plagued by whatever that plague is. Verse 19, this shall be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all nations, not just Egypt, but all nations that come not up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. So this isn't a invitation. Well, if you feel like it, you know, and if it's not too much of a bother, and if, you know, you can get the time off, we'd like to invite you to the feast. It's a requirement. It will be a requirement. So, you know, at least initially, there'll be different groups of people going up to the feast in Jerusalem. And sometimes you think, well, what about the logistics of all those people? How will all the earth's inhabitants gather there? You know, I've heard ministers speculate that maybe the heads of families will go up as representatives. You know, that, of course, could be the case. But then again, if you think about it, if they do it that way, that removes the family aspect of keeping the feast, where the entire family is keeping it together. So, you know, we could speculate that maybe every so many years the male head of the household will attend, or that the rest of the time the feast will be kept with families in local areas like we do today. Well, the reality is, and the truth is, we don't exactly know, because it doesn't tell you exactly. It just does say, though, and that we know for a fact that the Feast of Tabernacles will be kept at that point in time. You know, I think it'd be pretty spectacular if everyone were able to meet at the same time. It would have to be a pretty penetrating and powerful sound system so that everyone could hear. However, if Jesus could talk and speak to 5,000 people as he did, and everyone could hear him, it doesn't take much of a leap in your imagination to visualize him doing it by multiple numbers to multiple numbers of people. You know, the thing about us is we look at things in a physical manner based on what we know, what we can observe, what we can see, but that doesn't begin to tell us, you know, what God is capable of doing and what he's going to do. So we can speculate about a lot of different things, but the reality is we won't know until that time comes. You know, if there are others who speak who are spirit beings, of course they'll have the same capabilities and will have powerful voices able to be projected for long distances so that everyone will hear and understand. But as I say, we don't know what it's going to look like, but the one thing we know is that it will work. 1 Corinthians 14, verse 8. 1 Corinthians 14, verse 8. For if the trumpet give an uncertain sound, who shall prepare himself to the battle? You know, if you don't understand what the trumpet means because they hit a sour note, or they miss a note, or they don't do it exactly in the way they're supposed to, the troops are all going to be milling around. They're not going to know what to do. And that's just an example. God isn't going to have all the nations assemble for the feast and then allow conditions to exist where they don't understand what is being said because they can't hear or understand the speaker. I think it's pretty easy to understand that. We know it'll be a phenomenal experience for all of us to see when it actually occurs. The survivors of the tribulation, including a lot of the young people in the church who have not been baptized and will live over into the millennium, they'll help their parents and their relatives in dealing with young survivors in other nations who have never known God and His plan or His way of life. They'll be dealing with other teens who have been raised and been taught by their own parents to believe something totally different than what's going to take place, what's actually happening, and they'll have to be taught and be able to understand an entirely new way of thinking. You know, they're going to be exposed to a new way of life that'll be very foreign to them. To what they have thought or what they've believed before. So it'll be a real transition for them. And when you think about it, where would you better find someone to take on that task than a teen who has spent multiple years going to pre-teen camps or teen camps and has actually experienced the unity and the wonderful environment and the things they've been able to learn at those camps and those moments together. And because of that, they can strongly and confidently explain it because they've actually had the chance to experience it. You know, I don't think it's too difficult for us to stretch our minds to think about things like this. You know, when you view the world today, these events may be occurring in the not-too-distant future, especially if you look at the conditions around you now. In John 16, verse 33, Jesus said, "These things I've spoken unto you, that in me you might have peace. In the world, you shall have tribulation." That's a guarantee. You don't know how it's going to come. You don't know how it's going to affect you, and you don't know for how long, but there's a guarantee that you will have tribulation. But going on, he says, "Be of good cheer. You can have a happy ending. I have overcome the world." And that applies to all of us as well. We too can overcome it. You know, isn't that something that we would like to see happen? If the prelude to the tribulation started tonight, and I don't know exactly how you would define that or how you would draw a line to determine that, but say that it did. If things started to move into place, that something big was going on and something out of the ordinary, not just affecting in your neighborhood, but the entire United States. You know, would you be able to look ahead and think about the peaceful ending because you know it's going to end in peace? What would your reaction to that be? You know, those of us who are older might really welcome it. You know, our aching bodies won't terminate in death and we'll live right on into the millennium strong and healthy. you know, those who are younger might think, oh, I was just getting ready to retire and I have all this time to myself to travel, you know, to go to London or Paris or Rome. Well, how about just substituting that for Pluto, Venus, Mars, the moon, the sun, the galaxies, whatever. You know, we can't begin to, I don't know how, if you look up in the sky at night and look at the millions and billions of stars and those that you can't see, how we can put our minds around exactly what it's going to be like. But we do know, Paul says, we see through a glass darkly, and we know that we can't begin to understand what it will be like. We just know that it'll be wonderful. So how do we know when this will occur? 2 Timothy 3, verse 1. 2 Timothy 3, verse 1, which doesn't particularly give you a specific time, but it does give you an age. It does give you the dimensions of a culture. He said, "This know also, that in the last days perilous times shall come. For men shall be lovers of themselves," or their own selves, "covetous, boasters," John touched on that in his sermonette, "proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy," verse 4, "traitors, heady, high-minded, lovers of pleasures more than lovers of God." You know, it's for sure none of them will be leaders in the world tomorrow initially. They will have to be taught a new way as well. Let's look at a few of these traits and compare them to what's going on in society around us, what it looks like today. How about lovers of themselves? You know, we're a nation of selfies. You know, every time there's the slightest provocation, out comes the camera. Look at this nice hedge back here, and I'm in it. And all this hummingbird feeder, you know, and just about anything, out comes the iPhone or and a picture. But this is what is going on around us today. You know, Veronica and I kid each other a lot, and it's not in a demeaning manner where we're putting each other down, but in a joking manner. Usually, after being married as long as we have, we know exactly the kind of spin or inflection we can put on our voice so we aren't misunderstood. We pretty well know and understand our boundaries, that what we say isn't meant to be derogatory, but that instead is done in a teasing, affectionate, and playful manner. Sometimes she'll call me Farquhar, and that's not, and she was doing this years before the DuckTales came out in 2011, where he was known as a clumsy Agent X. Now, if you put a saw, hammer, or pliers in my hands, if you want to see clumsy, that's probably a good analogy. What about being covetous? There's certainly nothing wrong with admiring someone's new car or their house or their boat or whatever the item is. But when we get an immediate pang of jealousy or an intense feeling of dissatisfaction, because those feelings are evoked in us, then we need to review the source of that. Where does that come from? What should our reactions be when we see someone who's received some special blessing? You know, we should rejoice with them and not go away upset and dissatisfied because we haven't received the same blessing. Romans 12, 15. Romans 12, verse 15. "Rejoice with them that do rejoice and weep with them that weep." Do we find it immensely easier to weep with someone when they fall on hard times and to rejoice with them when they receive unexpected blessings? You have to answer that and think about it. What about boasters? And here again, John touched on that. Have you ever been around a group of your friends, and this can happen at any age, and someone in the group starts to boast about something that he or she has done and or acquired? You know how that makes everyone feel. What about proud? There certainly isn't anything wrong with being proud of work we've done that reflects, you know, superior or high quality value, and which shows other people an example of our work ethic, our values, our morals. If it's reflecting that, then certainly, you know, that's an example and gives the world a good example of what a Christian is like. However, if we flaunt it and act like we're superior to others around us, that definitely sends the wrong message. Turn to Luke 14, verse 7. Luke 14, verse 7. And he put forth a parable to those which were bidden when he marked how they chose out the chief rooms, saying unto them, when thou art bidden of any man to a wedding, sit not down in the highest room, lest a more honorable man than thou be bidden of him. And he that bade thee and him come and say unto thee, give this man place, and thou begin with shame to take the lowest room. So if you walk into some kind of a celebration, or maybe even a wedding, and you walk up and sit down on the front row, well, I think most of us would understand, we wouldn't do that, but something similar. And then someone comes in who is supposed to sit there, it was reserved for them, and so right in front of everyone else, a full crowd, you are told you have to get up and go to the back of the room. And that'd be pretty embarrassing. Give this man place, and thou begin with shame to take the lowest room. So, verse 10, when thou art bidden, go and sit down in the lowest room. You know, sit in the back row. Don't take the front row. When he that bade thee cometh, he may say unto thee, friend, go up higher. Then shalt thou have worship in the presence of them that sit at meat with thee. So put yourself in a situation where you're invited to come up and not have to suffer the consequences of going where you shouldn't have been to begin with, and then hearing them tell you you have to go to the back. What about blasphemers? Have you ever watched what is touted or described as comedy on the networks from which you rent movies or programs? You know, there are very few that I've run across that capture my attention for more than a few minutes. Most of the comedians spew forth a stream of filth and rely on curse words to punctuate their delivery. You know, whatever humor they may have is, if anything, is obscured by the crass language they use. It makes a person cringe when you hear a stream of words taking God's name in vain, and it's difficult to sit through for even a few minutes. I was surprised a few weeks ago when we were visiting my son in Los Angeles and his family. A friend of my granddaughter, Juliet, had stopped by to visit her, and she stayed for dinner. And now they're both 16. While we were eating, she was describing something, and just out of the clear blue, she said, Jesus Christ. Now, when we say Jesus Christ, we say it with reverence. We say it with respect. We say it with honor. But that wasn't the way she was saying it. I mean, it was four times louder than my voice saying it, and it was an expletive, the way she was using it, you know, it's exclamation point. Didn't they know any better, you know? That's what she said, Jesus Christ, didn't they know any better? And, you know, now she's a very striking Persian girl, and up to that point, I had a lot of respect for her, but that was a real turnoff, and I wondered how she'd become Juliet's friend. Well, after she left, Greg told me that the girl didn't have much of a home life, and she liked to come to their home because Greg's family was a real warm and welcoming family to her. And that's what she thought a real family should look like. Well, that's the world we live in. What about being disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, traitors, heady, high-minded, lovers of pleasures more than lovers of God? I'm not going to take those and go through them because I don't really think I need to. I think that you get the point. You know, this is a microcosm of what today's society and the world around us is like. It's an example of a culture we live in. You know, I don't think any of us enjoy seeing people suffer. And yet that is what is happening throughout the world today. People are suffering physically, financially, emotionally, while nations are poised on the brink of war in the Middle East. It really is a tinderbox waiting to explode, and all it's going to take is the right events to trigger a war machine that's solely designed to capture Jerusalem and destroy Israel. If you don't think the plans are going on all the time for that event to happen, then you haven't read the news. But the time is coming when the Eternal will return to subdue all the nations of the world. And instead of that kind of planning and that kind of thinking and that kind of consequences as a result of those actions, we will finally have a lasting peace. There'll no longer be differences between Jews and Gentiles or any races for that matter. Because we're all going to be worshiping the same God. We will all be planning to keep the feast together, and emphasis on the world, on the word, I should say, together. So as we begin to make preparations for the feast this fall, we need to remember what it portends and to be thankful that we know and that we understand God's perfect plan.